Nexus PMG welcomes you to the Bigger Than Us podcast, which we as energy geeks lovingly refer to as the BTU. Bigger Than Us is a podcast that focuses on ideas that will shape the future of our planet and ultimately our existence. We will occasionally lean into energy topics because, after all, it's the key to our collective survival, but we'll also explore other ideas and topics that we believe will have an impact that is bigger than us. And now, on to today's show. Hello, and welcome to the Bigger Than Us podcast. I'm your host, Raj Daniels, and today I'd like to welcome NJ Ayuk to the show. NJ Ayuk is the executive chairman of the African Energy Chamber, CEO of the Pan-African corporate law conglomerate, Centurion Law Group, and the author of Big Barrels, as well as Amazon and Wall Street Journal's best-selling Billions at Play, The Future of African Energy and Doing Deals. His experience includes advising major companies and governments on energy issues and investment strategies. NJ, how are you doing today?
I'm doing amazing, Raj. How are you?
NJ, I'm doing fantastic. And as listeners might know, this is going to be a very special show for me because my parents are actually born in East Africa, and today I'm going to interview an expert regarding the energy situation in Africa. So I'm very excited to speak with you.
I am honored, man. Your parents were born in Africa. Africa is in your soul, in everything, and it would never leave you. So we hope you come back home soon.
I plan to. So let's start with this. Broad overview. What do we need to know about Africa's energy crisis?
Africa is at a crisis point, and I could describe it this way. 600 million people in Africa do not have access to any electricity. 900 million have no access to clean cooking technologies. They have to use biomass, and they have to cut trees in order to cook and in order to stay warm. Most of them women. That is what I call energy poverty. And we need to defeat that if we are going to be able to meet energy access and energy demand for every person within this continent.
So let me play perhaps devil's advocate. It's Africa. It's over there, halfway across the world. You know, why is the African energy crisis important to Americans?
I think it's very important to Americans. It's very easy. The United States of America is part of the United Nations and wants us to meet the Sustainable Development Goals. If you can't do that, you would not be able to meet that. Second aspect of why it's important to Americans. Americans are more concerned about climate change and energy transition. Climate change and energy poverty are two sides of the same coins, and Americans need to pay attention to that. Third, the more people don't have energy security, the more Africans who don't have food security because they have no energy, it creates a new wave of migration. And people will have to migrate into different countries to search for greener pastures. And we keep seeing the clashes around the borders of people trying to look for better and greener pastures somewhere else. And also, why is it important for Americans? Free market capitalism, something that America has done so well. Americans have a great opportunity to see a problem and fix it. This is Africa's energy crisis can be of great interest to Americans because American ingenuity at its best has always been solution-driven, solution-focused, creating those solutions where if we see a 600 million put out electricity, we say, damn it, how do we fix it and how do we make money? And if there's one thing that Americans love is they love money. And this is an opportunity for them to see and find solutions to create, to do good, and still make loads of money.
But NJ, we have so much to deal with here at home. How can we even think about Africa right now?
I think that's a challenge to say you have so much to deal with right at home. I think the real issue that you have to look at with Africa is also that America's energy security is also linked and tied with Africa. Give you an example. 7 African nations are part of OPEC. When President Biden goes out and say you need to increase oil production, you are not going to be able to increase oil production in the markets to fix your price at the pump in America without paying attention on oil production in Africa. So these African countries can be able, and this is where the partnership works, they can be able to produce a lot of oil and natural gas that would fix Africa's energy security problems, at the same time address the solutions and problems for everyday American at the pump. We are having these discussions in March right now. In a few months, it's going to be summer. Summer in America, everybody takes up their big super tankers and nice fancy cars, and they are out on summer vacations, driving across the I-94 and interstate highways. You are going to need to really tank those cars. But if the price at the pump is so high, it is an economic issue for Americans because you just don't have enough money to continue paying for high gas prices. And Africa does offer a solution to that. We have to find a way to make it a win-win for both Africans and also for Americans. And not just American corporates or American entrepreneurs, but everyday American citizens that can also see their lives getting better. So we are all interconnected in this.
So quick geography lesson, which 7 countries in Africa are part of OPEC?
Man, you're trying to send me to school again. I think that's Libya. that's Libya, Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, Gabon, Congo, Brazzaville, Angola, and I guess that's it. And Algeria, that's the last one. Algeria, they are members of OPEC. And I think that is, most people don't know when they think about OPEC, they think about Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Iraq and Iran. But African countries are so influential in OPEC in decisions when it comes to supply gluts, whether you need to cut production or increase production, and they have a heavy sway on the market. And I've been one of the few people who are not ministers. I'm a nobody. I've been one of the few people to get a chance to sit in that OPEC cloakroom and sit and deal with the deliberations. And African countries do have a very strong voice to determine and sway the market. Imagine the United States working closely with its African partners. It can also help a lot as we engage in some of these dialogues on how to increase production, reduce production, look at how we get natural gas into Europe and sway the tide to ensure that we don't have a situation where gas is being used as a weapon of war.
So speaking of weapon of war, we're about 1 year into the Russian invasion of Ukraine. How have attitudes changed? And I'm going to paint with a broad brush here, but how have Western attitudes, Europe, America's attitudes towards Africa changed pre-war and post-war?
I could hardly get anybody to pick up my phone calls to talk about energy investments in Africa before the war. They wouldn't talk to me. I would go into conferences, into meetings, and I sit with there as the African guy, and I'm shouting, "Drill, baby, drill! Listen, I have gas, I have everything." Nobody. I felt like a guy was so lonely in the club, and I'm good looking. But imagine a good looking guy going to the club and feeling so lonely. That's how I felt. But then when the war break, I had everybody from every nook and cranny calling me and saying, where do I find natural gas? Where do I get gas feedstock for Europe and all of that? That changed. But then I think what really happened with that was that They wanted the gas, but they don't want to do the investment. At the same time, they were still saying, we are not going to invest in pipelines and in drilling for natural gas, which we have abundant natural gas in Africa. We're not going to do that, but you need to get the gas. You know, you can't get gas if you don't drill for it. You can't get gas if you don't go into field development programs and do pipelines and do floating LNGs and be able to produce that. Then at the same time, Europe had declared natural gas as green energy and nuclear as green energy. But wait a minute, Raj, it is not green energy for Africa. And I think we got really disturbed by that message that gas is green for the wealthy countries, but for the poor countries, gas is not green for you. So investment should not go there. So there has been a lot of pressure on financial institutions to not invest in our continent because they should not invest in our fossil fuels. And that pressure is something which we do not like. But at the same time, we're having pressure to provide more gas to powerful and rich nations. And so the hypocrisy and the inconsistency in policy making when it comes to energy, we think is something that is not very helpful.
So I do sense the hypocrisy. I know there are some conversations during COP26 regarding views of countries towards Africa. And then I think there was quite a severe turnabout, 180 degrees maybe, in COP27 about the reliance. You're on the ground in Africa much more frequently than I am. What is the sentiment amongst the African countries that you're dealing with in Africa regarding this turnaround?
I mean, I discussed with many African presidents in private and oil company executives in private. And I tell you this, for many Africans, even those who are nobody, and they saw COP26 in Glasgow. And you, I don't know if you watch TV, it was quite a show. 400 private jets flying into this little tiny airport in Glasgow. They all having Scottish breakfast. I showed up there, and boy, you wouldn't believe it. They have this breakfast. I don't know what they call it. The Scottish have this meal they call haggis. And everybody, I mean, you eat that, you felt like you're eating grits and chitlins. And you still have to smile, you know. And they walked right in. And what happened? Everyone had these pledges. No more oil. No more. Nothing should happen. We all need to drive a Tesla. And we need to provide all cars have to be Teslas by 2030, and 65% of the cars that should be, no more investment in boilers and all of that. And we're going to change our diet. They told us not to eat meat. And they said we should drink goat milk and almond milk, and we shouldn't go on holidays anymore. Then 3 months later, Norway, Africans are thinking, okay, this is what you've told us. But then 3 months later, Africans see Norway giving out 52 oil licenses. And then they see Germany building LNG terminals. The UK opens its first coal mines in 30 years. Germany opening coal-fired plants. The US opens all federal lands for drilling. And they said, but what kind of game is this? You know, there's an old saying, I mean, Raji from Texas, it's an old saying that, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And then we had gotten into these things where they said, because of climate change, we need to do all of these things. And Africans, leave your resources in the ground. Yes, we know you are in the dark, but that's not a problem. But that's what happens. We promise you guys $100 billion in climate adaptation funds. That check didn't come. That check came like what Dr. King said in his march in Washington, a bounce check. It didn't come. The check, they've been promising $100 billion every year, for the last 13 years, nothing came. So when Africans see that, they are very, very concerned. And then they have no option right now. It's a turn to looking east and say, we have no option but to work with our Chinese counterparts, because at least they are not being hypocritical on how they see energy. They want to produce more energy. They don't want to see us be in the dark. And I think that you're seeing those forces walking around Africa. And I think we must not miss this big moment where American values, American democracy, democratic values, American market values, and American ingenuity has to play a role. And that's why we call for a more pragmatic, common sense approach towards the energy transition, which allows us to take care of energy needs, energy sufficiency, while fighting climate change at the same time. And don't forget, Raj, many African countries, Africa, when you look at the global atlas for greenhouse gas emissions, Africa is only at 2.73%. compared to most of the Western countries. So you can't decarbonize what is not carbonized. So the wealthy nations need to decarbonize. African nations need to industrialize. And that's where we are on this issue.
You know, I'm glad you brought up China. And while I don't want you to make any speculation, I exchanged emails, I think I told you before recording, with Dr. Mofor from the UN. And it was specifically around the idea of, you know, rare earth minerals. It was regarding cobalt from Congo. And the Chinese are doing a lot in Africa. You know, they're trying to forgive debt. They're speaking of putting, you know, processing facilities for these rare earth metals. What do you think, again, broadly speaking, the West or America can do to perhaps circumvent or prevent China from monopolizing these minerals?
We, like I said in my book, we can have an EV revolution, we can have a mineral revolution, but I think this is where Western capital comes into play. You spend time with the processing of the minerals in Africa, create inverse in this entire supply chains. Africans, you cannot replace the fossil fuel industry with a new industry that doesn't allow Africans to be part of the supply chain. Africans should be part of the supply chains. Africans should participate. But I think the international community, especially the American investors, have to look at the DRC and say, we got to invest in this deal. We got to come in there and look at the copper belt and look at everything, and then say, we would go in there and use our technologies to drive that. And part of it is you need to show up. You need to be with the people, you need to engage them. You need to open structures which are financeable, which are bankable. Some of the biggest mining conferences in the world, they're not in China. It's in Toronto, Canada, PDAC, and in the United States. We need to use the markets, the stock markets, and create those vehicles that allows us to go look at lithium, cobalt, and platinum, and all and rare earth minerals, so much potential in this continent that are going to be part of the critical metals that are needed for the transition. If we play that and we really engage that, but also see Africans as partners, not as people to be exploited. They have to be partners. They have to be, we are no longer in the 60s or the 70s where people just came in to take the raw materials. We want to industrialize. We want to create those jobs for our young people so they don't have to cross the Mediterranean to go find jobs in Europe or go create an immigration crisis in Europe. They should be able to find jobs right here at home and build their families.
Now, I do have a little pet peeve about people painting Africa with, you know, homogenous, it's 53, 54 countries. I want to ask, and this question might not go anywhere, but I'm just curious since I have you here. Can you give your opinion on what's going on in South Africa right now? I've been reading about it. I've been watching about it, their energy problems. Do you have any insight into what's going on in South Africa?
South Africa's energy energy crisis has been a mixed bag of many things. There has been the corruption, which did not help. There has been the mismanagement of critical energy infrastructure, for decades. And this is what happens when you don't fix critical energy infrastructure. And also the regulatory bottleneck, which do not allow for new power producers to come in the market. You had a big government monopoly in Eskom that was not working. This is what happens when big government runs everything and politicians running energy. That's the problem. When you look at on their gas site, you can't even shoot seismic like in South Africa because of the environmentalists who are preventing us. I mean, it's amazing how people sit in Western countries and are preventing an African country from shooting seismic because they think that is the world is going to end, but they're doing it. And at the same time, we have had a heavy reliance on coal. And if we're doing an energy transition and we are not replacing coal, you have to replace coal with something. Base load. You need to replace coal with possibly natural gas so that you have base load so that you can, because wind and solar, with all due respect, it is intermittent. It is intermittent. I'll give you an example. You need 100 megawatt, a 100 megawatt wind or solar plant to give you about 30 megawatts in the grid and perform very well. We saw what happened in the state of Texas with wind farms. I'm not saying renewables are not good. We need to phase in renewables, but a lot more work has to be done on technology. While we look at the future, we have to live today. We have to read today. We have to eat today. And that's where South Africa is. South Africa is facing 8 to 10 hours daily on 8 to 10 hours of blackouts per day. That's not acceptable. This is Africa's most industrialized nation. You cannot run industries with generators and inverters. You can run industries with batteries. You need that baseload power and to really be able to drive it up and manufacture and produce for Africa and create jobs and really help people to become what they dream to, to fulfill their dreams and fulfill their ambitions.
You know, the Eskom story is fascinating all the way down to the fact, I'm going to say fact, but the previous CEO, there was an attempted poisoning, I believe.
There was an attempted poisoning of a previous CEO. He made those allegations. I think the police and law enforcement are looking at it. But I think the previous CEO had an amazing opportunity to fix infrastructure. He did not fix it. I think he's a smart guy, but this was a guy whom there was not a TV camera or a Zoom call that he didn't like. He thought he was running he was running a show business. He wanted to be part of TMZ, and he liked the limelight a little bit too much than actually managing, operating, leading, providing vision, and driving an energy company that is worth multi-billion in dollars, and you are running an energy company where the country is losing $1 billion a day because of a crisis. You should not be spending time hanging out on Zooms and tweets and doing every kind of talk show that you want. The only person that can do that and still run a country is President Trump, and he's not Trump, so he should have focused on doing his job rather than engaging too much on the show business.
Now I want to change gears here. NJ, you've been named one of Forbes' top 10 most influential Africans. And there's a brief bullet that says, NJ is on a mission to make energy accessible to all people and to raise awareness of the African energy crisis. And one of the core questions that I like to ask is, why? Why do you do what you do? What drives you?
What drives me, I grew up in a very small town in a village in Cameroon with no electricity. And I saw what the difference electricity meant when I lived in Europe and the United States. As a student going to school, I saw the power of what energy could do to transform people's lives when it regards to education. And to be honest, I had been given so much by my American education that opened so much doors for me, gave me a sense of entrepreneurship, gave me a sense of thinking about thinking big and dreaming big. And when you look at that and I look at Africa and I said, I know people who were better, smarter, more intelligent than me that could have really reached their full potential, but they just stuck in villages and communities which have no energy. So they can't read, they can't write, and they can't reach their full potential. I know community clinics that could save lives, but they cannot get the electricity they have. So the equipment that they have, that, you know, some fancy, really nice people have given them in that community clinic or hospital would not function because of no electricity. And I look at it and I said, if I have this much influence to sway public opinion, to talk to leaders and presidents, I don't just want to sit before the president or a minister or a business executive and talk only about profits and my ability to make more money or my ability to get more things for myself. I want to be able to hold them, their feet to the fire and say, what are we doing about energy poverty? Because when we fix the energy poverty issue, we are fixing climate issues, we are fixing development issues, but bottom line, we are fixing families, because the family is the most essential component into every African society, and family values do matter, but you cannot have family values in the dark.
So let's double click. You said you were in Cameroon, small village. Tell us your story. How did you manage to leave?
I was very lucky to have a beautiful German family that, I didn't choose them, they choose me. And so they became really fascinated by the work I did in the community as a young man. And they took me on as a guardian family to live in Germany with them. So I spent time, grew up in Germany, and, you know, part of my best lines I used to use to get girls when I was young was that I spoke German, even though German sounds like a very boring language. And then so I grew up staying in Germany and went to school and then moved to the United States and then went to University of Maryland, College Park. And after University of Maryland, went to law school in the United States. And then after working with the UN for a little while, with the United Nations, I think I was a little bit confused. I decided to go back to business school. And then I thought, after going and studying for an MBA, it just made me a better lawyer. And I think I had the bug to work in corporations. I was lucky as well, right early on, to get a chance to work for Becker Botts. It's a big US law firm, and they basically gave me so much and opened so much doors for me and really kept me focused. But then Africa was always around, and I had to work in the Middle East and doing work with my law firm in Africa, which Centurion Law Firm, we built it from scratch with a few good lawyers and grew it to become one of Africa's largest energy law firms. And then we did something that nobody ever thought. We became the first African professional service firm to be listed in the German stock exchange. And so we said, we're not just going to build this, but we're going to take it to a bigger level, and we're going to list in the stock market to really ensure that we stay right on top corporate governance, but open it up for people to be able to invest, grow, but let our services then be able to transform. So today we providing services in the United States, in Canada, in Germany, in the United Arab Emirates, and across 17 African countries. And that gives me joy every day to see a lot of young lawyers that we trained, we built. We sent a lot of them to Western countries to learn and come back to the continent and kept that exchange because we think if we are going to have the Africa we deserve, we need to invest in people and we need to build them up and make them to become the best, bring out the best out of them so that we can see that they can be active participants in a transformation of our continent.
And yeah, it's a beautiful story, beautiful story. Now, I'm going to ask a question about the future. I usually ask a question 10 years into the future, but before we started recording, I think the numbers you shared with me was in 20 years, Africa is going to have a population or is forecasted to have a population of about 2.8 billion people. Is that correct?
That's right.
So if we continue down the current path, what are the struggles? What are the challenges? And if we start investing in Africa, what are the opportunities? So take one at a time.
Energy is going to be a big challenge. Our numbers of energy poverty are going to continue increasing. If we don't invest right now to really fix the economies, you cannot have any African economy operating at its maximum capacity without the right kind of energy systems in place to really drive that up. So what's going to happen, 2.8 billion people, the majority of them are going to be young people between the ages of 15 to 30. That is a very, very important population. We're going to see a lot of issues around political risk if we don't sort out issues for young people, and energy issues are going to play a critical role in that. Now, where do I see opportunity? I see so much opportunity in driving up and providing energy for most. At that point, you're going to see about 2 billion people are going to be having either intermittent energy or no energy. And that we must fix, because if we don't do that, we are going to be see us increase our climate challenge bigger. But beyond that, you're going to see a continent that is going to be the consumer of the world. It's going to be bigger than China. It's going to be able to manufacture, produce, and drive goods. Right now, you have the Intra-Africa Trade Agreement, which allows, for example, U.S. companies to pick a jurisdiction or an African country that they like, produce, manufacture, and take it all across the continent without tariffs and without duties and be able to serve a market. So you're going to see opportunities around electronic vehicles that are going to be the cars of the future. But you're going to see also big gas players. United States is very, very pragmatic in approach to say that gas is going to be around for the long, long term. And Africa as a continent is not going to abandon gas. Africans are going to produce more gas for electricity, for petrochemicals. So we can produce urea, ammonia, NPK, fertilizer plants, and drive up agriculture so we secure our food security rather than relying on Russia and Ukraine to provide fertilizers, which we are spending almost $2 billion every quarter to buy fertilizers to power agricultural bases. We would be able to do that with our gas feedstock from Africa. That's big opportunity. But also looking at a young, more vibrant Africa where a lot of people are engaged in critical mineral exploration, but bigger than that, artificial intelligence. Africans today are more connected with cell phones and they're on everything from WhatsApp to Instagram to TikTok. That's how you've been able to see a new generation that is driving up, that knows what they want. Their purchasing power is increasing like nothing I've ever seen, but they're also determining better quality. They want to see better quality products in the market, and they are going for it, especially the young Africans. They deserve better. They want better. They don't want to be like their fathers, whom they believe were very docile, and they were passive bystanders to so much opportunities they want to be part of. So I see that Africa, and I see a future, but we got to put action to it. You know, they always say there's nothing so powerful than an idea that sticks with you. Then you put action to it. It means that idea's time has come. Marching armies would not stop you. So as an African, I am hopeful of the future, especially working with our international partners and everything. I say this, one of my biggest heroes in life was Martin Luther King Jr., who taught us that the arc of a moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But the truth of the matter is that Dr. King would tell you today, Raj, that it doesn't bend by itself. It is Africans like me and you and well-wishers and everybody around the world, we are the ones that can help shape it and bend it towards that way. And that's what we must do with energy and energy poverty, because if we improve energy in Africa, we improve Africa and we'll create a secured world.
NJ, I love that. Last question here, and I'm going to make it very specific for you. You know, a lot of the audience may not be as current on the situation in Africa, obviously, as you are. You know, I like to do reading because I have an interest. But if you could share some words of advice, perhaps, of where people can perhaps plug in, learn more about what's going on in Africa from an energy perspective, and even from a broader, perhaps, commerce perspective, what would you tell them? Where to look?
Join the African Energy Chamber. We are the largest institution in Africa when it comes to energy. But also, look at US government reports on African energy. The International Energy, the IEA, has great reports on energy in Africa. I don't agree with them most of the time. Sometimes they can be a little cuckoo in some of the things they say. But I do think that it's really important to look at those things and the markets. And also understand that when you start looking at energy and what we do at the chamber and how we embrace all forms of energy. By the way, that's why in my book I said, and making energy poverty with an energy mix, we are not against coal, we are not against oil, we are not against natural gas, we are not against renewables. We think it has to be like that. You know, you go to Louisiana, they got this gumbo. You know, it's a gumbo. You get a combo and that's it. All of that, both energy. That's what we believe at the chamber. And then you would be able to get a lot of sources. And we love Americans in Africa. You know, we think, I always say, when you see Americans, you know, you go to Hilton Hotel in any major city, you see these Americans, they are loud, they are boisterous, some of them are fat, and then you say, Yankee, go home, but take me with you. You get beautiful people, Africans and Americans are like peanut butter and jelly. They get along very well together.
Well, NJ, it's been a blast talking to you, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor, and I really appreciate what you do and giving an African a chance to be on your podcast and bring some of our Africans' views on African energy to a bigger world. The honor is mine, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review on iTunes. And you can show your support by sharing our show with a friend or reach out to us on social media, where you'll find us under our Nexus PMG handle. If there's a subject or topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email, btu@nexuspmg.com, or contact me via our website, nexuspmg.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter, where we share what we're reading and thinking about in the clean tech, green tech sectors. Bigger Than Us is a Nexus PMG production.